Hello and welcome to Round Peg Podcast. I'm your host, Ali Borhani, geostrategy expert with Business Families Foundation and the managing director of 360 Strategic Advisors. Joining me today on April 22nd, 2020, in our post-COVID era of social distancing via Skype and all the way from Toronto, Canada, is Craig Kilberger. Craig is the co-founder of We Charity, We Social Enterprise, and We Day Entrepreneur Humanitarian Days. He's a New York Times best-selling author. He went to the world at the age of 12, inspiring to make a difference for the people and to see how he can eradicate child poverty and child labor. 24 years later, I'm talking to Craig Kilberger to see what he and his organization have accomplished. Craig Kilberger, welcome to Round Peg Podcast.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to join you.
Your story has gone around the world many times. One thing that caught my attention was the December of 1995, when you as a 12-year-old ventured into a different environment completely. In the midst of the carpet and rug mafia after the story of Iqbal Masih's unfortunate murder in Pakistan, you ended up in India. Do you believe in destiny? Do you think that things happen for a reason or not?
It's a great question. Yeah, I believe that we are presented in our lives with opportunities on a daily basis. And I think those opportunities can lead us towards creating a better or, frankly, a more inequitable world. And it's a question of whether we act on them. You know, the way I think of destiny, I once think of an exchange I had with Archbishop Desmond Tutu when I was quite young at the time. And I said to him how I stopped reading the newspaper because it was full of all the negativity in the world. And he looked at me and he said, that's not, you know, a simple newspaper, that's God's to-do list delivered to your front door. And it's your choice whether you engage with it or not. So I think people, you know, nudge opportunities in our path, but I think it's our choice whether we choose to engage.
Well, that's a very, sophisticated way of putting it, and rightly and correctly. At the same time, when you stood up and you told your parents that you want to go and help children who are child labor in far-fetched land, what was their reaction? I mean, how did they respond to you as a 12-year-old that, you know, you want to go out and help?
Oh, they said, absolutely no. I'm not permitted to go traveling to Asia on my own. To provide the context that leads up to that, it was April 1995, when I read the story that first inspired the founding of this small group of friends in my living room. And over the summer months, we did car washes and bake sales with a goal of trying to build a school for these children who we read about who were working as modern day slaves. And then come September, I sat down with my parents and said, okay, well, I want to build a school. I want to find out how we can help. I want to go to Asia. And I had a map and not the most sophisticated approach. And I said, my parents are both school teachers. So I said, don't worry, you won't have to miss school. I'll go on my own. And I asked them if I could take 2 months off school. This was in eighth grade. And of course, they said, no, absolutely not. You know, you're not allowed to take the subway downtown Toronto by yourself. Never mind, go to Asia by yourself. And so there was a lot of pleading and a lot of begging and shoveling driveways to save up money and finding a chaperone to take me and all of these components before they finally relented that I could set off on that journey about 6 months later.
That's fascinating. And Alam Ramin, who was almost twice your age at that time, who was your guide and companion, how did he come to your way? Did you get to know him from parents, or do you knew him, or did you know him, or how did that come about?
Mm-hmm. So in April 95, when I read that story about child labor, to provide context, you know, I know we all know this, but this was before the internet was in every household, before Facebook existed, The first thing we did was open the Yellow Pages, which, as I tell this story to young people these days, they'll often ask me, what is that? and then explain that, you know, set off on this journey that to the local library to find out ways to help, and eventually ended up at this youth organization that was dedicated to helping young people make a difference. And he was a mentor there. And so he became a friend, he became a mentor, you know, and being in his 20s, you know, to us, he seemed ancient and wise. And he was from Southeast Asia originally, his family was from Bangladesh. And so when he finished his university studies, he said he was going to travel through Southeast Asia to find himself, to learn about his culture. And the minute he said that in September, or October, I suppose, I grabbed hold of his arm and I said, you have to take me with you, which I'm sure was exactly what a 20-something-year-old wanted, was a 12-year-old tagging along with him on their gap year. And I said, you have to take me with you. And I also have a full schedule of where we should go. You know, he wasn't interested in the issue of child labor, but he was kind and planned to take a year to travel and said, sure, you know, a couple of weeks, you know, happy to chaperone you. And a couple of weeks grew into a couple of months. And the most amazing part about that story is Alam Rahman, who was, you know, born in Toronto and studied at University of Toronto and planned to have a very, you know, typical life here in many ways, never came back after that trip. After what we saw, after the reality of child labor, after going on, you know, raids, bringing kids back home, after doing advocacy work in the field, when I came back home after that trip, you know, we were testifying in front of congressional committees with my friends, and he never came back home and stayed in Southeast Asia to organize global marches and the work there on the issue of child labor. It both changed our lives so profoundly over the past 25 years.
That's amazing. Are you still in touch with him? Is he still active, or have you? So basically, my question is that he may have been your very first mentor, as you said. Have you kept in touch with that mentor, or do you have new mentors actively?
Oh well, both. Certainly, new mentors also. But you know, as an interesting twist of fate, we both celebrate the same birthday. And so on December 17th every year is our opportunity to reconnect and to reminisce and to check in with each other's lives. And, you know, I know I'm jumping around a little bit as we share this journey, but I'll never forget in the final days of that first 2-month trip through Southeast Asia. I was this trip that changed my life. I was 12 years old, had my 13th birthday, spent time with Mother Teresa, went on raids, interrupted a trade delegation. It's surreal, all that took place. Alam as the mentor on that journey, I remember in the last week, as I was getting ready to leave, I couldn't imagine coming home. And frankly, I couldn't imagine not having my mentor there side by side with me. And he described this idea. He said, I think to truly create change, we need two sides of the equation. You know, on one hand, we need here at the time, here in Southeast Asia, we need to see, you know, the protests, the rallies, and the grassroots development take place. And he had this dream of marches. We had been taking place in a series of marches. We joined freed children. And he said, imagine if there was a global march. And he dreamt up this idea. And he said, on the other hand, in North America, you need to make sure that we galvanize and mobilize people to care for international development, for governments to fund sustainable development, for creating alternatives for these kids. And these two sides of the coin, the analogy that he used, really drove both of our lives, where he made that march happen. It was a global march. The global march was actually awarded with the Nobel Peace Prize. Kailash Satyarthi, who led the march, as Alam did most of the work organizing, received the Nobel Prize for this. And in North America, you know, we've continued to engage here with now millions of young people who have become involved in service work with us, and have helped globally to build 2,000 schools and schoolhouses and clean water and medical for about 1 million kids and families in extreme poverty around the world. So it was both sides of these coins about how we create change in the world to truly end the worst forms of poverty, to truly create that equality, that sense of basic justice. We need to look at both the developed and developing world.
So when you see, when I started with Destiny, it's that what are the chances of finding a companion, a friend who shares exactly the same birthday, ends up leaving with you, staying back, and you coming back and still remaining together. But that's a fabulous story. You are 36 now, if I'm not making a mistake. So the first trip at the age of 12 and two cycles of 12 years have gone by, 24 years in total in between.
How has the organization evolved, in your opinion? And would you have imagined to be where you are today? And when you look into the rear mirror view, is this something that you thought of? Is this part of your dream and what you and Mark are trying to achieve? Is this a dream come true, or is it part of the ambition?
I think it's a dream that is written in many chapters, and parts of it certainly come true and parts of it still remain. When we created the organization, we didn't set out to start a charity. The first thing we did was we called other very well-known charities and said, we want to help. And they said, you're 12. How you can help is you can send money. In fact, one group actually said to us, if you really want to help, you know, your parents keep their credit card. And that was the attitude at the time. And so the first part of the dream was really at home in trying to engage young people and to shift this idea that young people were too young to truly make a meaningful contribution. I believe that youth need to start at the youngest of ages to care with compassion and empathy and a commitment to service. And so there's a whole slew of programs we now have that reach millions of young people every year who do service work with us, who fundraise for various causes, who learn, and this is baked right into their school curriculum, who learn about various ways that they can serve, from coding during their classes in computer science to working with international villages as they learn Spanish, to testing their water through biology, all of this around youth service. So there's this whole slew of resources. That was a dream that has come to fruition. You know, we dreamed that it would be cool for young people to want to make a difference. And now we've, you know, seen stadiums filled. We bring our members together, and about 250,000 will fill a stadium every year. In different locations, from Wembley to LA, from New York to the Caribbean, from North America to Vancouver and Toronto, that you know, we'll have about 20,000 per stadium, and we'll do this in multiple stadiums every year to have about a total of 250,000 annually come together to celebrate in different locations. You know, that we dreamt of. The goal of freeing every child around the world, ending global poverty, that is a dream that is written in chapters. You know, when we started, we had no development projects. You know, now schools, 2,000 of them, clean water, medical programs around the world. But that's still only part of that dream. That dream will take a generation, and frankly, might even take more than that. You know, passing batons through time to make the world a little bit of a better place every single time someone takes the baton. So that part of the dream is still very much to be written. And then, of course, right now with COVID-19 in the world, you know, we're seeing that dreams sometimes have unexpected chapters, and that may set us back in time. But we're still leaning forward as much as we can to try to provide the impact and to try to make that impact as beneficial as possible to as many lives as possible.
I hear you saying many chapters. In more ways than one, you have grown from a journey of yourself, and I've watched some of those videos, and particularly the one touched me was where you were talking to the gentleman in India, where the kids were separating those needles, and to where you are today. So that was a very touching clip from your video and your journey. But you are at the same time building a business, and you and Mark are in more ways than one, given that your parents were teachers, you are the first generation of a family business. How is that as an experience for you and Mark? What are the challenges in terms of your journey in developing a family business together?
I think it's the most wonderful journey of all. You know, to be able to do this side by side with my brother. You know, I remember when I was a kid starting this, 12 years old, very quickly waving my arms and needing help. You know, in the years that grew as the organization became larger, my brother, there was a moment where he did his undergrad at Harvard. He was a Rhodes Scholar, studied law at Oxford, and had these job offers in front of him to pursue whatever he wanted, investment banking, consulting, et cetera. And And we had this heart-to-heart conversation. And at the time, this was a fledgling children's charity. It was a fraction of any salary imaginable in the other life path. But it was something that we both believed in, and most importantly, also something we could do together. And that became one of the greatest gifts. It's actually, my brother and I are 6 years apart. So it's what actually brought us closer together was this journey.
And what are the biggest challenges in taking this forward for the two of you at the moment? What keeps you awake at night other than the issues in and around COVID and the 1.5 billion children that are out of the schools? At a more business level for you as an organization, what are the growth pains? What have been the key learnings between you and Mark in this journey?
We operate a very unique business, as you would say, because we have two branches. One is a conventional charity, and one is a social enterprise where we sell products and services to fund the charity. But at the end of the day, why we exist is fundamentally to advance social good. And the charitable world inherently has a number of limitations that hold back its growth. And so where we struggle often is trying to unlock things like technology or the traditional capital levers that enable exponential growth. And that's why we started a series of social enterprises, why we started a fair trade coffee line, where we started a trips and travel with EcoLodge, why we started a technology licensing company that tracks social good with companies. So all of this enables us to, in essence, tap into the best of the nonprofit, the mission, the purpose, the drive, with also the best of the for-profit, the conventional leveraging of debt and seeking investors and bringing earned income revenue models into play. So what keeps us awake at night is always finding that fine balance between the two. You know, every choice we make, it's how do you both grow and maximize the social impact, but you have to maximize both the profit and you have to maximize the good. And that's a very fine and very thoughtful daily balance.
So Craig, I know that your calling started with eradicating child labor. This day and age, a lot of us are taking high horses and beating our chest of being environmentally conscious for driving electric cars and, cobalt and lithium, and a lot of these minerals still come from some of the harshest extractive industries in countries like Congo. And then they're called artisan miners and they're child laborers. How does that go against the grain of what you are doing in terms of creating awareness? How do we find a little bit better of visibility in supply chain in products, in your opinion? That if I'm riding an electric car, not to name names, I don't get excited that I'm doing an environmentally good work while not being visible to the fact that the very battery I'm using or pieces of my car may have been put together at upstream by child labor workforce.
There's no easy answers, as you rightfully point out, but I would never let the perfect get in the way of the possible. So for those who are choosing in whatever path to lean in, I do want to applaud them because it isn't easy. But we do have to, as you said, always continuously strive to be better. And I think within that, that's where we need to innovate in the nonprofit world. The traditional model of dropping a dollar into a tin cup and hoping that it does some good in the world, or as you say, even the traditional models of simply, purchasing certain products and we expect that they will somehow do good in the world, that isn't sufficient. Let me use technology you described with an electric car. Let me use it another way. So your phone today can track a car to show up and pick you up. It can track an order that's couriered and delivered to you. It can track your calories. It can track your running. It can track, but why can't it track your impact? So we developed a piece of technology called Track Your Impact that we partner with companies on, and they are able to both tell the origin story of where that product originated from, but also the social impact story of what the good is achieved through the purchase. And it was, in essence, developed through geotagging technology, where we're able to transparently show. So let me use an example. Someone buys Unilever produces a lot of tea in parts of Kenya. Someone buys the product. We look at the source origin. We ensure that a portion of the proceeds go to train the women who pick the tea on how they have financial literacy to lift their family out of poverty in a sustained way. This is all very possible. We do this, others do this. So it's a question of us pushing companies to be leaders, not in the simple way, but in the more complex way. We need to adopt the same supply chain practices, the same transparency, the same technology to now show social good. And as consumers, we always need to demand and push for more action.
I hear you loud and clear, and I think that with blockchain and geotagging, many of these hidden spaces for certain multinationals will be very hard to maintain in their supply chain. Are you concerned about social distancing and We Days and your events? Is this something that you and Mark are thinking to have digital online We Days moving forward, or do you think that life will go back to normal and you will still have 500,000 young, energetic youth coming to the stadiums? Where do you think that's going?
I think that based on the epidemiologists that we're working with around the world, because we partially on a global level, we built hospitals, we run medical operations, we have a medical college in Africa. So we get to look at that data very closely. That data tells me that we will not have a return to normal in the near term. And so for something like We Days, we'll shift them to digital celebrations to honor kids through the service that they do. You know, and frankly, you know, we had a great run. 1.5 million came live to attend the various events over the years, 250,000 averaged a year. You know, now we shift onto the next evolution. And I don't think that's a bad thing. And at this time of great disruption, when I bring our team together, I say that this is just continual evolution. And although in this case, this wasn't driven by our choice, this is an opportunity to be better. When I look at the history of the organization, we started initially kicking down doors to free child slaves. And we quickly realized that wasn't a solution because the kids would end up back in the same conditions. Then we started building schools. And we realized that wasn't enough, because we had to provide clean water and medical, and then it kept growing and evolving. We started We Schools in North America to inspire kids, and we realized we needed a reward. That's why we created We Day. All of this is just continual evolution. So I believe that the models, the nonprofit world, the traditional models of the nonprofit world move far too slowly to evolve. We're still running charities like in the time of Charles Dickens, leveraging technology, creative destruction, things coming and going. We Days, absolutely digital, will be great, but it will keep evolving in ways that I can't even begin to imagine right now.
You have met a great lineup of people, from TV celebrities, from Jean Chrétien, whom I hold in a very high light as a fellow Canadian, Al Gore, Malala. Who has touched you most? I know it's an unfair question, but who has left an impact on you that you said that was a right hook of sobriety and wisdom, and you will remember frequently or more frequently than the others? Who are the top two or three influencers in that lineup?
You know, we have been very fortunate, both for our work, but also hosting We Days, to bring everyone from Malala to the Dalai Lama, to travel through Africa for a week with Malala to host her first trip there, or to spend time with, Prince Harry and Meghan, who are great ambassadors and support the work, and great people. So we are incredibly fortunate. This is one of the great blessings of this work. To be pressed to a name, though, I would go to the first person I ever met who literally brought me to tears meeting them, and that was Mother Teresa. And back to how this conversation first started, when I was 12 years old in December 1995, a few days after my birthday, I was in Calcutta at the Mother House, and with Alam, my friend and guide, and the two of us together. And frankly, we had no business being there. There was no charity at that time. We weren't inviting people to speak to big events. We had, I would just walk through the doors, offered to help. And Mother Teresa greeted me out of curiosity, what a child was doing so far from home, and then patiently sat And we had this beautiful long conversation where I spoke about this organization, what we were trying to do, and how, you know, 7-8 months earlier, I'd read this story about child labor and how I was here and wanting to learn how I could make a difference. And all of this evolved long after the mother house closed, and her staff tried to wrap up the conversation many times and she just waved them away. And she, you know, wrote a beautiful message on a chalkboard to all visitors to say, please pray for the world's child laborers. And in that moment, what I loved about it the most was the fact that she had a million people who likely came through the mother house, literally, you know, probably in any given year, constant people. And she still stopped with a humility and a grace and a connectivity with one person. And at being a 12-year-old without money, without power, without influence, she still realized that I mattered because of the compassion. And I think that's one of the great tests. What we do when no one else is looking, how we engage with others who may not traditionally register as powerful in today's society. And in my mind, she is still the most extraordinary person I've ever met for her authenticity and her integrity of how she lived that mission.
Well, thank you for sharing that experience. What is your gut feel when you hear that President Trump has cut the funding for WHO in the midst of a crisis? How does that make you feel as a social activist, as somebody who's running a charity? What goes through your mind when you hear that?
Well, to answer that question, I need to describe what was going on the same day I heard that. So earlier that same day, we had been working with our team in East Africa. And we're the primary hospital. We have one of our larger hospitals there. And our hospital network supports about 800,000 people. So we had heard that a quarter, we're doing door knocking campaigns, a quarter of the population had never heard of COVID-19 in these rural communities without electricity or news. No idea how to protect themselves, of course, or that they had to. We looked at the number of beds that we had and realized how woefully insufficient they were and how we had to start bringing all of our tents and emptying out our dorms or our secondary schools and emptying out our college so we'd have those dorms to put patients. And bracing for what Bill Gates has said could be 10 million lives lost in sub-Saharan Africa. And so with that in the back of my mind, I hear President Trump's comments about pulling funding on the WHO. And anger, and moral outrage, and a feeling of absolute rage at that, because it means that so many lives needlessly will be lost. And the truth is, as bad as COVID is here, you know, the U.S. is able to write multi-trillion-dollar bailouts. And you know, there's hundreds of billions of dollars to support various social systems, social welfare, and hospitals. That's not the luxury in developing countries. And WHO is one of the few institutions on a global level that can handle as many regions to provide that holistic global solution. So it's incredibly disingenuous on an idea of caring for human life around the world. And the truth of that is that then it's a call to action for the rest of us. It's a call to action for ordinary individuals to say, if you fundamentally believe that a human life matters, we have to step into that gap now. And particularly for the poorest countries in the world, there is a need to urgently rally to give very basic care. I'm not talking about ventilators here. I'm talking about soap. I'm talking about basic food security to prevent not hunger, but starvation. Like, this is the reality in these communities, and this is the call that we have to respond to now as a society.
And another concern I carry, Craig, is the outstanding fiscal imbalances in many of these emerging and developing countries, for that matter, which have been, you know, under the prescription of various financial institutions, hedge funds, and in the time of need, now they're being left alone. So I hear you loud and clear. Do you and Mark have any view of where you want to take this mission? I know the pillars of, you know, women in employment, eradication of child labor, but we point, how do you say, we 2.0, 3.0, 4.0, what do you like it to be? You know, is it a juggernaut as a social enterprise? Is it a multifaceted charitable organization? And what can go wrong, in your opinion? What are the risks in the model of what you're trying to accomplish together?
In the short term, we have no ambitions to try to create a juggernaut of an organization. To be candid, when many charities are pulling back their funding around the world, rightfully so, because their budgets are getting squeezed, we're choosing the opposite choice. We're leaning in very heavily, and we're fighting with everything we've got to maintain the communities, especially around the world, with food security and public health outreach and running our hospitals. And we know that what this means is that the organization is going to be much smaller on the other side of this. We're spending down everything we've got. And that means that we have. And so, you know, it is a conscious choice to say that 25 years has prepared us for this moment. And I'm fine with the organization being a fraction of its size at the other end of this if we have fought tooth and nail to protect every life we can. And so in the short, you know, that's our mission. And in the medium to the long, I think that the financial implications of this are going to be severe for society. A lot of people are going to suffer in the short, medium, and even long term with the debt repayment necessary. And so given that reality, we're banking on social enterprise. I think that conventional charity will stumble. I think that people will struggle to write very large checks, but there's still a lot of family offices, family foundations that can invest through their endowment, through social enterprises, and actually get their capital back and then some, you know, probably modest returns, but to actually have their capital returned intact and know that in the process, they've been able to advance business solutions to tackle some of the greatest challenges facing our time, including health and global health, including economic inclusion, including climate protection. So when I look at how our charity has grown, the biggest engine behind us has been building and scaling social enterprises. And in our 2.0 model, we want to find other great social enterprises and connect them to the capital of endowments and investments so that that capital flow can exponentially increase their business model to create social good. So for us, we always believe in innovation, but I think this is where the future lies of the nonprofit world, or that hybrid between profit and nonprofit. I think that for the listeners, many of whom I know have family offices, many who have family foundations, I would gently challenge them to see, is their traditional blended portfolio the right investment strategy? How much of that is allocated towards social impact investing? Because that's how, in an age of limited ability to give money, we can invest money and still achieve extraordinary positive impact.
I couldn't agree more. I think maybe just as a thought and thinking loud with you as having a heart-to-heart conversation, maybe it would be worthwhile developing a dashboard in the day and age of negative interest rates and falling asset prices of what sort of comparative returns for doing good, as you're saying, always making doing good doable, to showcase to some of these families. I think that would be of quite of interest and perfectly timed. Now, one last question. You had a notebook with you and you were scribbling faster than I can type today on that journey in India. Have you kept that notebook? Have you revisited those handwritings? And if yes, how often, how frequently? And have your readings changed from the notes you took on that, life-changing trip?
Yes, I have to say, I haven't thought of that notebook in a long time. And so that's quite a thoughtful question. I first reached for it after the trip when I took the trip experience and wrote a book called Free the Children. And it became a bit of the mantra for the organization, a bit of a playbook of how we wanted to change the world. And that continued to grow and scale, and that went around the world in, you know, dozen plus languages, and we were incredibly lucky that to this day kids still read it, and they'll send letters saying, you know, they want to join, and they were inspired by that journey, and they find Alum in the book and Mother Teresa in the book and our first journeys with the raids and bringing kids back home in the book. But truthfully, you know, it's been probably over 20 years since I've looked at those journals. And what I will say is that whenever, you know, I think back to those days, I remember the time feeling so powerless to help. But the one promise I could make all these kids who I met back on that trip was that we would take their stories and share them with whomever we met. That the one thing we could do, we couldn't build them a school, we couldn't take them out of their reality, but we could at least share their story. And over the past 25 years, that's the one promise above all else that's driven all that we've done, and still to this day.
Well, on that note, I am sure that, you know, in revisiting some of those pages, you should take a great sense of achievement in what you have accomplished, and I'm sure a new empowerment for many other things that you and Mark and the organization will hopefully continue to do so. I wanted to thank you for joining me on Round Peg Podcast, Craig. I'm sure this conversation is to be continued in the near future. In the meantime, stay healthy, safe, and good luck with everything you and the team are doing at We Charity.
Thank you, and thank you for the honor of joining you today.
I'd like to thank my guest, Craig Kielburger. Thank you all for listening. I hope you can join us on our next podcast, where I will be joined by Dennis Jaffe. Dennis is a family business scholar at the Smith Family Business Initiative at Cornell University, a faculty advisor to Ultra High Net Worth Institute, and an author of various books and a connoisseur of family businesses. We will be discussing about the challenges, the beauties, and the complexities in working, running, and functioning within a family business.
You've been listening to Round Peg Podcast, brought to you by Business Families Foundation and 360 Strategic Advisors. We hope you really liked what you heard today. You can always subscribe on Spotify, iTunes, or other platforms to hear the next conversation and our new episodes as soon as they become available.